This is a feedback loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 19th episode. First, I want to thank each of our listeners who voted in the poll on social media to help us pick which article to review. Based on those results, we return to the JES to look at a recent article that examines the relationship between glycemic variability and preserved insulin production in recently diagnosed type 1 diabetes. The authors use observational data obtained cross-sectionally from subjects participating in a randomized controlled trial, so we will think carefully about how they design their study and how that affects the interpretation of the data. As a quick reminder, I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast and work as a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt, where I am the medical director and associate director for the fellowship program. Back today as our regular contributor and joining us from the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, is Steve Whitland. Steve is also a general endocrinologist and the clinical director at Rochester, but has a special clinical and research focus on diabetes and diabetes technology. Our guest expert today is Adrian Vella from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Adrian is recognized internationally for his expertise in diabetes, including for his research into underlying mechanisms of the pathophysiology and treatment of type 2 diabetes. He has numerous publications and editorships that help attest to this expertise. So, as you can tell, I have the right two people joining me today to dissect this article. As usual, everything we say is our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. For this episode, we review measurement of peak C-peptide at diagnosis informs glycemic control, but not hypoglycemia in adults with type 1 diabetes. This was published in the Journal of the Endocrine Society in October 2021. Alice L.J. Carr at the University of Exeter Medical School in the UK served as the first author for this article. Steve, I will now let you highlight the key points that these authors make in their introduction and let you and Adrian both give us an overview of some key points we need to keep in mind for this study. Steve?
So in or beginning with the diabetes control and complication trial and its extension EDIC, it's been demonstrated that there's some residual beta cell function in patients with type 1 diabetes. And in fact, in an article published from the Joslin Clinic with their 50-year Joslin medalists, they demonstrated that a significant number of patients make some C-peptide, i.e., there's some residual insulin secretion. And in the DCCT EDIC, it was shown that residual beta cell function portends a lower hemoglobin A1C, less glycemic variability, a lower average blood glucose, and down the road, less severe hypoglycemia. So fast forward about 30 to 35 years, and we have a new tool called continuous glucose monitoring, which allows us to get more data than the 7-point glucose profiles that were performed in the DCCT. So there was recently a study in children that looked at C-peptide as a measurement of residual beta cell function and dysglycemia at the disease onset at type 1 diabetes. And they showed a similar correlation between C-peptide and hyperglycemia and time in range, which we'll discuss, but not hypoglycemia. So Adrian, what do you think about the glycemic variability at the onset of the disease and its correlation with future glycemic variability down the road?
It's an excellent question. And we don't really have an answer to it, because there are so many variables that can change glycemic variability, behavior being one of the more prominent ones. So I think variability at disease onset is probably very different to what happens 30 years down the road. Here we are focusing on insulin secretion or residual insulin secretion, and whether it is truly insulin secretion in the way we understand it, as a physiologic regulator, something we'll discuss later, I think. But the point here is that there are two parts to glycemic control, right? The ability to make insulin, and then the ability to respond to that insulin. And those factors are going to change because with increasing weight, for example, amongst individuals, there may be some degree of impairment in insulin action. So I would hesitate to offer a sweeping statement saying that glycemic variability at onset is going to really predict glycemic variability later, because there are so many factors that can change it, and independently of whether you have residual insulin secretion or not.
Just going back to the introduction to the study, so we have a pediatric study that looked at the effect of residual beta cell function at onset, but they report there's no similar study in adults using continuous glucose monitoring to match that. And so really that is the purpose of this study. And so their aim is to see how and if stimulated C-peptide as a measurement of residual beta cell function predicts dysglycemia in newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes.
And now we're going to look at the methods, and we always go pretty slowly through the methods to really try to understand exactly how the authors design their study. We'll go particularly slowly here. There's a lot of aspects that we want to make sure that we're discussing, and that I'm going to have Steve and Adrian and make sure that we understand as we go through them point by point. So first of all, what we'll do is, I mentioned earlier that this is a cross-sectional study. So we're going to think about how this works here, and then we'll actually dive into this particular study. So as a reminder, cross-sectional studies take a group of subjects and they measure all of the data of interest at a single point in time. And this is important because we will often think of observational studies in the terms of a cohort study, and cohort studies will divide subjects into group and then follow them over time. You have an exposed and an unexposed group, sometimes multiple groups with different degrees of exposure. But in that situation, you're able to identify upfront whether or not an individual that is a subject has had an outcome or not. That is very different in cross-sectional studies, because in those you collect all the data at once. And while you have a hypothesis up front, you have mechanisms that you're proposing or driving the relationship between the exposure and the outcome. All of that data comes at once. You can't really prove just with that approach that the exposure does predate the outcome. So I think that's something that we'll need to keep in mind, and we'll come back to here shortly. Okay, so now we're going to go back into this study and really think carefully about the methods here. So this study, it's a secondary analysis of the exercise and type 1 diabetes, the XTOD, EXTOD study. So what that is, exercise and type 1 diabetes state. So let's do that first. So that study was a pilot study. It was an RCT that was exploring whether the exercise of subjects would preserve beta cell function. And for that RCT, they recruited subjects between November 2011 and January 2014 from 19 different NHS sites in the UK. And to be a part of that study, you had to have type 1 diabetes that had been diagnosed within 3 months. You had to be using a basal bolus multiple daily injection approach for insulin, and you had to have a C-peptide that was above 200 picomoles per liter at 90 minutes after meal stimulation. And then as a final inclusion criteria, you had to be an adult. And so they defined that for this study as ages 18 to 60. So that raised a point in my mind, a question that I had that I wanted Adrian to help us with. And that's thinking about when we study adults, you often get this question of type 1 diabetes versus LADA, and is there really a difference? Is it just a spectrum and it can't really tease it out? It's not that important anyway. Or does it make a difference that potentially a lot of individuals in this study had LADA, and that's going to affect how we think about this? So Adrian, can you help us think through how including folks with ages 18 to 60 would really affect potential results and those implications of those findings?
When residents and fellows ask me this question, my retort is usually that LADA is a Russian car. And in actual fact, the term LADA was invented for somebody's thesis research project. That somebody was Leaf Group, actually, who at one point publicly disavowed the term and apologized for the confusion it has caused. I think it is type 1 diabetes. I think it so happens that they have the people with LADA compared to people who present age 6 months or age 6 years have less genes that predispose them to type 1 diabetes. They tend to have less markers. It's just a form first of type 1 diabetes, basically. And as such, they may have a slower loss of beta cell function over time. But we are having, I mean, as I think we're going to discuss with the methodology, there are significant limitations to the methodologies we have to measure residual beta cell function. And certainly there are huge financial limitations, time limitations, to actually studying such things longitudinally. So that's the limitation there, kind of thing.
I think we as human beings tend to dichotomize things. We like to have categories rather than think of individuals. I think that if one looks at autoimmune diabetes as a group, then you're asking a question that doesn't need to be answered. On the other hand, the latter patients can go for years without requiring insulin. So to the extent that you think that sparing insulin is a good thing, then there is some use to defining someone as having severe insulinopenia versus having slow burn autoimmune diabetes. Adrian, I have a question for you though, because I went back because in the C-peptide literature, there are basically three different ways of expressing the units of C-peptide level. And if I convert it correctly, a C-peptide above 200 picomoles per liter, as in this study, is the equivalent of 0.2 in the DCCT trial. So saying that the patients had to have over 200 nanomoles per liter is defining them as having some significant residual beta cell function, as opposed to the group that was defined as the high risk in the DCCT.
Of course, the problem with interpreting a C-peptide value at any one point in time is that there are many variables that change that C-peptide value. First of all, we have to remember that concentration represents a balance between secretion and clearance. So if people have renal impairment, not likely in this setting, but people who have renal impairment will accumulate C-peptide. That's one of the reasons why C-peptide isn't reliable when we're working up hypoglycemia in people with renal failure, et cetera, et cetera. The second thing is that fasting insulin and C-peptide secretion in health has a pretty strong linear relationship with weight, because obviously secretion and insulin action. So you have to be able, which we cannot, the limitations of our tools at the present time cannot accurately equate a fasting C-peptide as being appropriate or otherwise to a patient's weight. And then when you're measuring it in response to a stimulus, there are factors such as the timing after the stimulus and the nature of the stimulus, which affects the C-peptide response. So a C-peptide at a single point in time, I think here, what it's doing in the fasting state is establishing that there is some residual C-peptide secretion, some residual C-peptide that is leaking into the circulation. How efficacious or otherwise it is obviously variable.
So we'll think about here in a second how the authors assess C-peptide and the interpretation that they make from that. But I think it is helpful outlining the how to think about these folks as not a distinct group if they have folks that we might otherwise classify as LADA, but just really thinking of that as a spectrum. And that's really what we're trying to identify, folks who are more on the spectrum of preserved insulin secretion. And so we need to be thinking about that as we move forward. Good. So finally here, again, as we think about this RCT, this initial study from which our study came from. So when they did this, the investigators had initially 507 subjects that they identified, 214 they were able to assess for eligibility. And then of those, 58 were randomized to control or intervention. And then in that group, 26 subjects had CGM data. So this is the group that they're taking the subjects from for this cross-sectional study. Now, of those 26, only 23 were able to be involved in this study. A couple had data that wasn't usable, but I thought one exclusion was important. This is, I wanted to get Adrian's thoughts on this again, because this is relevant to how we think about wrestling, classifying diabetes, is they excluded one individual because this person didn't clearly meet criteria for having type 1 diabetes. And they define that as having one or more positive antibodies or a type 1 diabetes genetic risk score that was greater than the 50th percentile and a BMI that was less than 30. So Adrian, can you help us understand? I know there's lots of ongoing debate about exactly how we're supposed to classify diabetes. Steve has already pointed out that we are way too lumpy and putting people into clear categories when it's not that clear. So when we think about this, particularly in research studies where we're trying to figure out what type of diabetes somebody has, what are our approaches to this, to the approach that the authors use? Is that a good one? Are there other ways that should be thinking about? Can you just give us your thoughts on that, those questions?
It is a difficult problem. And in fact, the trick question I ask residents and fellows is, what is the way to diagnose type 1 diabetes? And the answer would be pancreatic biopsy, which obviously we never do. And we're certainly very good at differentiating the people at the ends of the spectrum, clearly. But and then there are people where it's less difficult and less easy and less clear cut. Now, I must say that the Exeter group, and there are authors in this paper who have contributed to this, have been excellent at developing genetic risk scores, for example, to help differentiate people at higher risk of type 1 versus type 2. So the short answer is, again, there is no definitive test which is going to clearly, other than historical, once people have been followed for a long time, but there's no definitive test which is going to clearly differentiate between type 1 and type 2. And we will have to accept that there may be some contamination, quote unquote, of the cohort. Given the age range, it's possible that there will be a few, but I think the way they did it is probably one of the better methods.
And as a second point here, to think a little bit more about the use of continuous glucose monitoring. So the device they used was the Dexcom G4, and that was blinded. And the subjects in this had home glucose monitoring via usual care. And typically for these folks, they wore the CGM for 7 to 8 days. And the authors go through some fairly extensive review of the assessments that they did to ensure the validity of the data. And they point out later in their discussion, that's really a strong point of how they assess that to make sure that this is reliable data. But Steve, I wanted to get your input here. So this is really your bailiwick of understanding technology for diabetes. So with CGM, there are some limitations, particularly when it comes to hypoglycemia. So give us some of your thoughts about how you would think about the limitations of continuous glucose monitoring as it exists in its current form for accurately detecting hypoglycemia in individuals.
We're talking about a moving target. And part of the issue here is that this is a Dexcom G4, and we're all prescribing Dexcom G6s at the present time. And who knows, by time most people listen to this recording, we may be doing G7s. But I think that historically and up to the present, interstitial glucose monitoring is more accurate in the normal and high range than it is in the very low range. And so in this particular study, they talk about the MARD, the mean absolute relative difference. And for those who aren't familiar with this term, if you had 15% of the values all above a given number in error and 15% below, if you average them all out, the test would look perfect. And so we make all errors into absolute numbers. So an MARD of 20% means that the mean absolute relative difference, whether it's above or below the gold standard, is 20%. If you're dealing clinically with a blood sugar of 180 milligrams per deciliter, if you're off by 10%, it's not that clinically relevant. If it's 165 or if it's 195, you're not going to do something that's that different. On the other hand, if we call our current target range 70 to 180 milligrams per deciliter, and if the blood sugar is 70 milligrams per deciliter, a 10% error, and we're allowing here an MARD of 20, a 10% error is already 63 milligrams per deciliter. So you could attribute hypoglycemia to someone who doesn't have hypoglycemia based on the CGM. And vice versa, someone could have a blood sugar of 63 milligrams per deciliter and you're reading it as normal. So that's just technical. The other issue is that these CGMs are less accurate, particularly from the era of the G4, which is several years ago, are less accurate in the very low range than they are, as I said, in the normal and high range. The third aspect is if you sleep on the sensor, you can create false lows. They're called compression lows. And my handy dandy solution for that is to tell people to put pillows next to the side they tend to roll on to avoid rolling on it and getting awake in the middle of the night from a compression low. So there are some issues with the measurement that's being used, even though it's the best they had at the time.
So next thing to think about is the assessment of beta cell function. Adrian's given us a little bit of an overview already about different ways that we can try to figure that out. And in this study in particular, they assessed beta cell function at a few different points in time. And it was different for different subjects, but it could be at baseline or at 6 months or 12 months. And the way they did it was with a mixed meal tolerance test with assessing that C-peptide afterwards. So Adrian, give us your thoughts. You mentioned a little bit already about some limitations, particularly with fasting C-peptide measurements, but what would your thoughts be about measuring it in this situation, how helpful that is, or is there a better way to try to figure out what someone's residual beta cell function might be?
There are various ways of doing that, and everything might have a role. So, for example, one of the possibilities would be to do a supraphysiologic stimulus, like giving arginine or glucagon and measuring the C-peptide response at 1 minute to that stimulus. And certainly, there are papers where people have tried to classify patients based on the response to these stimuli. Of course, the limitations of those stimuli are that they're way supraphysiologic in terms of the stimulus. So just because you can squeeze out some molecules of C-peptide from islets in response to 1 milligram of glucagon doesn't necessarily mean that a meal challenge is going to do that. So my bias, and certainly in my research, what I used most as a test of beta cell function is an oral challenge, be it glucose or be it a mixed meal. Most of the time, we go with 75 grams of glucose because that's easy to standardize. I think if you're really going to get an accurate assessment of beta cell function, you're going to need to measure an integrated C-peptide response rather than one finite point in time. Although again, in the islet transplant literature, a lot of people focus on the 120 minute C-peptide, or 90 minutes, sometimes, or 60 minutes. Usually for the dynamic function testing that I like to do to better characterize individuals, we usually sample at 7 points over a 2 hour period. So we have a whole relationship of glucose and C-peptide. And insulin too, but that's another matter. So one aspect is the secretion, right? How much comes out proportionate to the glucose challenge that they're exposed to. The second point, and then, is if you're going to measure beta cell function, you need some expression of the size of the rock they're trying to move and how efficacious that is. And that's a measure of insulin action, which can be modeled with minimal model type things. Over here, I think the question is, are their islets still capable of producing C-peptide? So in a sense, they're asking a question which is germane to this experiment, but it wouldn't be what I would call a measure of beta cell function, like a disposition index that's quantified from the minimal model.
That's a helpful clarification of exactly what they're doing and how that fits in well with this study. Good. So another question, this will be both for Steve and for Adrian. So they had mentioned that not only did they look at the A1Cs for these individuals, but they adjusted them and they did what they described as an insulin dose adjusted hemoglobin A1C calculation. That's not something that I'm familiar with. And I don't know if Steve or Adrian, if you all have any insight on exactly what that is or how that approach might work.
So my first reaction is that it's some sort of a fudge, which I would be reluctant to use. I'm not familiar with it and I don't use it. But there are certainly things that can be modeled in a cohort. So for example, there are equations where you just use demographic characteristics that can calculate an insulin action. And people have shown that these values correlate with values obtained from a clamp. But it's not quite the same as measuring things directly.
So this is taken from a paper in 2009 that was looking at the definition of partial remission, quote unquote, i.e. what we would call the honeymoon phase in children and adolescents. And they basically derive this factor, which it sounds like some analytic from basketball. It's the hemoglobin A1C plus 4 times the insulin dose. And they show that this correlates, I emphasize correlates, because in an individual patient, correlation may not mean much, and I'll come back to that, but it correlates with C-peptide. And so they use it as a surrogate for their study on partial remission. And this popped up again, and they actually cite the article, which is the only way I found it. But I'm not familiar with it being generally used in studies of this type.
So we'll come back to that and look at that and keep that caveat in mind as we look at those results. Okay, just a few final things here in the methods. So there were a few different protocols for when and how they obtained the CGM data for subjects. So of the 23, they actually got a total of 36 CGM traces that corresponded to times of this beta cell function assessment of these C-peptide measurements after the mixed meal tolerance test. And as a final word on thinking about the stats and really how the study is designed, so as a reminder, when we think about that classic terminology and observational study of exposure and outcome, the exposure here is that mixed meal tolerance test stimulated C-peptide level. And then the outcomes that they look at, a few different ones, but they're measures of glucose variability and hypoglycemia. And again, this is a cross-sectional study. So just to maybe perhaps be provocative here, I wanted to get Adrian's thoughts, because always, and I mentioned this before about cross-sectional studies in general, it's not necessarily clear from the study design itself what's an exposure and what's an outcome, because you're collecting all of that data at a single point in time. And I think at least as an exercise, when we read these studies, we need to ask the question of, well, could the relationship be opposite? Is it possible that what we've called an outcome, so here we would say glucose variability, is it possible that the outcome is actually what's driving the exposure, and that's why there's a relationship there, not the other way around? So Adrian, is there any way that we could come up with a plausible scenario for that, or do you think that really the one the authors have outlined is really the only plausible mechanism that we should be thinking about?
So it's a great question, and obviously cross-sectional studies have these sorts of limitations. However, it would be in keeping with the fact that they are measuring a C-peptide response and then correlating it with variability. So the C-peptide response is basically predicated on multiple things, as we said, and glucose toxicity, perhaps glucose variability, can affect beta cell function. Here we are studying people acutely in terms of beta cell function with the toxicity they have, so to speak. Is it chicken or egg? I mean, clearly, if you have more residual beta cell function, you would expect that there would be less variability. But could more variability negatively impact beta cell function? Usually, glucose toxicity occurs when people are exposed to high glucose concentrations for extended periods of time. So we talk about glucose toxicity being a significant factor in the setting, you know, of an A1C of 10% with symptoms. So I think it is more likely that insulin secretion affects variability. The only way to tease it out, of course, is to have the purest experiment possible, is to basically admit people to the CRU for an extended period of time, clamp their blood sugars less than 150 postprandial for a period of time, and then measure variability again.
That's helpful. And Steve will walk us through here in just a second. Group of relatively controlled diabetes here. So very unlikely that there's significant glucose toxicity here. So I think that's helpful for Adrian to walk us through that. Okay, good. So long, slow walk through the methodology. Hopefully we have a much better understanding of a lot of the different techniques that are being used here. So we're going to look at these results. Steve, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you walk us through all these numbers and help us make sense of the author's findings here.
All of the relevant numbers. So first I looked at the study population, and these are of white European descent. So its applicability to people who are not of white European descent is open to question. Secondly, the mean age was 27 years, which kind of addresses our how old was the general population. So it extends up to age 60 in eligibility. The average age was 27. The duration post-diagnosis was 2.5 months. The hemoglobin A1C mean was 8.3%, range was 6.6 to 9.1. I kind of translated the European values to American values. And the symptom duration was only 8 days, and 14% of the patients had DKA. Now, the mean meal peptide stimulated C-peptide was 865 picomoles per ml. So, Adrian, what does that tell us about the group and the possibility of them either being in a honeymoon phase or quote unquote LADA or whatever, given the 865 picomoles per liter?
that's not a very robust response. So in response to a mixed meal test, you would expect peak responses in the 2000 picomole per liter range, 2500 sometimes. So that's not a robust response. They clearly have significant beta cell impairment.
And the median insulin dose was a quarter of a unit per kg. I think this is a key point. I'm going to come back to the comment that this is a cross-sectional study based on this little segment. The CGM time points, 21 patients had baseline CGM values. Only 10 had values at 6 months and 6 at 12 months. And in two of the patients, the first time point was at 6 months. So it's conceivable that we're dealing with people at different stages of their loss of beta cell function and or the flip side, honeymoon phase, it's at 6 months. So it's cross-sectional, but it's not quite cross-sectional because a substantial minority are being evaluated 6 and 12 months after the baseline data. The outcomes, the wear time was 97.5%. The days of good data are 6.35 days out of a week. And the coefficient of variation is 32%, which falls into the international guideline recommended coefficient of variation for control. The time above range, level one is between 180 and 250, and that was 23%. And for level two, which is greater than 250, it was roughly 6%. And here I think this is key. The time in range was 68%. The target based on that international consensus for time in range for control is 70%. So this population was quite well controlled for people with fresh new onset type 1 diabetes. The time below range, and I think what I'm about to say is key to one of my questions about the study. The time below range was 0.63%, that's below 70. And the time below 54 milligrams per deciliter was 0%. So I think what's different about the conclusion of this study, jumping to the conclusion a second, and the title, is that they're saying that C-peptide at diagnosis does not affect the outcome of hypoglycemia or predict it. And I think it's kind of hard to say that when essentially nobody in the study has hypoglycemia. So Adrian's quoting what he tells his fellows. I always tell my fellows, if you have to give a presentation, if you look hard enough, you're going to find a recent article that addresses the issue. And in this case, 2 days ago, I opened up my fresh Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism for this month. And lo and behold, there is a study done by the Stanford group looking at kids, looking at clinically serious hypoglycemia in patients with new onset type 1 diabetes, and there's virtually none. So the question is, I think you need huge numbers to be able to address this issue because hypoglycemia is just not common at the onset of type 1 diabetes. The correlations, so this is really the key. They wanted to correlate their C-peptides and outcome, and they found that for every 100 picomole per liter C-peptide, glucose was lowered by 0.2 millimoles per liter. Remember, you have to multiply by 18. So that would be 9 milligrams per deciliter. And they lowered the standard deviation by 0.1. They improved the time in range by 2.6%. They decreased the time above range by 2.6%. And they decreased the level two, i.e. above 250 milligrams per deciliter by 1.3%. So, for all of us, are these correlations clinically meaningful?
So will it change clinical practice? No. It's not like we go around measuring C-peptide and telling patients, oh, good, the likelihood is that your glycemic control is going to be better than people who don't have any C-peptide. So, you know, you can be a little more relaxed with your insulin dosing post-meals. So it's a useful proof of concept, and it certainly fits with our preconceived notions, right? That if you have some residual beta cell function, you are likely to have less glucose variability. But these numbers aren't what you would call game changing, right? In terms of glycemic control. So it's useful to have, it's useful to know, but I don't think it's going to allow us to dichotomize patients and say, oh, for the first 2 years of your life, you probably could get away with a basal-only regimen. Clearly, these aren't that sort of patient anyway.
Yeah, I agree. Same thing. Not a huge difference in the degree of those numbers, but I think with a lot of what we're doing, particularly with folks who are relatively well controlled, I think that's a lot of the big issues there. There's not a huge range in the diabetes control. And so the opportunity to see differences there is not particularly huge.
The other question is, could this relationship be affected by other or confounded by other factors such as age, antibody status, glucose control? Should we look at that?
I don't know about age. The potential confounder would be if there is impaired renal function, which might make the C-peptide values look better than they actually are, so to speak. That doesn't seem to be the case here. Antibody status shouldn't really affect the relationship. Glycemic control, there are the limitations we discussed before. So, astutely pointed out, some people were evaluated at 6 months rather than at the time they were diagnosed. Those are the people who are in the 6.6 end of the range rather than the 9.1 end of the range in this study. So that might have factored in a little bit. You could argue that that is actually a conservative error and that is purer in the sense that they are well controlled at the time that this relationship is being studied. And it would be interesting to know how much they contributed to the relationship between C-peptide and glycemic variability.
So now we'll think about the discussion, and what we'll do is, as typical, we'll walk through the author's conclusions, how they look at their own data and what they draw from that, and then we'll add our own thoughts along the way. So first of all, the authors, they said they have several main conclusions. And so they say that higher C-peptide levels are associated with lower glycemic variability, more time in range, less hypoglycemia, but that there is not a connection with hypoglycemia. We'll come back to that. Steve's pointed that out already, but we'll circle back to that when the authors get to that and their limitations. At this point, then, the authors look at other literature that's out there, and as they is always the appropriate thing to do, try to see how that fits in with other literature to see if it goes along with that or if there's conflict that they have to try to explain. First of all, these authors point out that their data is largely consistent with data from that pediatric study that we looked at earlier, though not the lack of relationship between C-peptide and insulin dose or the hemoglobin A1c. And additionally, the authors point out that other studies of long-duration type 1 diabetes do show a relationship between C-peptide and protection from hypoglycemia. So the authors attempt to propose a model that puts those things together, in which they say that, well, perhaps residual C-peptide early in disease protects against hyperglycemia, while in later disease, it protects against hypoglycemia. And so I thought this would be a good point to get Adrian and Steve's thought on that. So they're, again, they're looking at data from different groups, different time points, and trying to fit that together. And it's speculative. So they're just suggesting that this may be the case. But what are you all's thoughts when looking at the data that's out there, if this is a reasonable model or if it's a bit too soon to be proposing something like that?
I have a couple of thoughts, if I may go first. So it comes with a disclaimer, as you know, I'm the site PI for DCCT EDIC. So anything published from DCCT EDIC, I have a favorable disposition to it. But early this year in JCI, the group published long-term, there are 12% of the DCCT EDIC cohort who still are C-peptide positive. And those people actually do have a decreased risk of hypoglycemia compared to the remaining cohort. The thing, though, is we don't really know the mechanism. So the C-peptide is a marker. I mean, the amount of C-peptide that's being leaked out rather than secreted, you could say, is probably not enough to meaningfully affect insulin dosage. So it's not like it's giving people a cushion for glycemic control, which might perhaps decrease the risk of hypoglycemia from a given insulin dose. Is it a marker of the survival and function of other islet cells, like alpha cells? Is it a marker of better glucose counter-regulation? I don't know, because it hasn't been studied. These are associations.
Adrian, just along those lines before I comment, could it be a marker of intra-islet communication between beta cells and alpha cells?
Oh, definitely. Now, confession here. I don't think it's completely true that insulin restrains the alpha cell. I do think it is true that the alpha cell can stimulate beta cell function, but I'm not completely sold on the idea that insulin restrains alpha cells. It may have a facilitative function, but I don't think it's as much of the brake as we think it is. We'll need to watch that space.
My impression from this is that we knew back in the 80s from the DCCT and certainly in the early 90s that residual beta cell function at onset correlated with glucose variability and hyperglycemia, and 5 years down the road, hypoglycemia. And subsequent studies have just echoed that in smaller studies than the DCCT EDIC. So to me, what was suggested to be different here was the lack of C-peptide predicting hypoglycemia early on. And I've stated my caveats previously. I just don't know that there's enough hypoglycemia early on to be able in a pilot study to make that statement. I think that you would need 1,441 patients, such as there were in the DCCT, to begin to draw that conclusion.
Now we'll think about some of the strengths as the authors describe them. So one, and we didn't go into detail on this, but the authors were very extensive in how they described their cleaning interpretation of the CGM data to make sure that's as reliable as possible. So they describe that as a strength of their study. They point out that the CGM is blinded. So we did talk about that a lot, but that is important. So if it hadn't been blinded, could have affected the behavior of the individual so that it when it was blinded, so that becomes more helpful information for what we're looking at here. They point out the strength of consistently using that stimulated measured C-peptide level, and then also that they had very specific criteria for diagnosing type 1 diabetes. The authors also point out several limitations that they have in their study. So they mention that it is retrospective and so always limited to what data is available when you do your investigation. They also point out that there is the possibility for a volunteer bias. And we did talk about this before, but I think that's a good thing that they pointed out is that often the individuals who volunteer for these studies are not representative of the population at large that you're interested in. So you can't necessarily conclude that the findings here are going to be applicable to every patient that you have. Steve pointed out when we were looking at this earlier is that the willingness of all of these individuals to exercise regularly, because that was the part of the larger RCT, really is a potential insight into that volunteer bias and how that might have an effect. The authors also point out they have a small sample size. And then finally, and this is an important thing, and we've talked about it already, but the authors, they do point this out very well, is that the limited hypoglycemia is really an issue here. So this is something that they acknowledge that it really does limit the conclusions that they could draw just because it didn't happen very much. So they do point that out nicely. Any other, Adrian, Steve, any other limitations that we haven't touched on already in addition to what the authors point out themselves about their
study? We sort of touched on it, but the dropout rate for CGM was surprisingly high. So at baseline, you've got 21 people. By 6 months, you've only got 10. And by 12 months, you've only got 6. So I don't know why, whether it's just people saying, I don't want any more of this inconvenience of wearing something for a week or not. But we have a high dropout rate, and that could theoretically affect the data. The other thing is, they don't use a Bonferroni correction in here. And whenever you're doing a cross-sectional study and measuring a whole bunch of variables, coming up with a P of 0.04 or a P of 0.06 when you've got more than 20 variables really is not the p-value that you're looking for.
Yeah, the Bonferroni correction, I think that's a difficult one to answer. I'm not a fan of the Bonferroni correction per se. There are other things to correct for multiple testing. I think that's a caveat. And it's well taken, Steve. I mean, I know exactly where you're coming from. I struggle with it too. But I would submit to you that sometimes the Bonferroni correction is a rather crude and insensitive correction to multiple testing, which may not be the best to apply.
As a non-statistician, I guess I was being somewhat sloppy. I think there needs to be some sort of correction for multiple variables.
I agree. Yeah, the problem is that Bonferroni may not be the best in this situation. Right. And sometimes we show our raw data kind of thing, and then people are allowed to make the conclusions that they can. It should be emphasized that, I mean, it's a piggyback study on a very complex study already. So the authors are to be commended for having the amount of data that they have to some extent.
Good. So let's actually move into that and thinking about the study overall. And so first of all, we'll say the author's summary that they state is that C-peptide retention has a measurable impact for a person with type 1 diabetes, particularly with glycemic variability. And then their implication is that measuring C-peptide reserve in newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes patients will influence how they are managed. And they suggest that that's something that should be fairly regularly done. So we're going to get to their implication here in just a second. It's been mentioned already. But first of all, just give us your thoughts, Adrian and Steve, about the quality of this report overall. Adrian, let's start with you.
Well, I think it's good that it reinforces the concept that endogenous insulin secretion could be helpful in decreasing glycemic variation or as a manifestation of glycemic variability. I would stop short of measuring C-peptide in the clinical setting. I mean, unless people are going to do it properly and serially, I think random C-peptide measurements, even in a clinical setting, are difficult to do. I mean, organizing a meal tolerance test, measuring C-peptide at given time points, extrapolating the right data from it is not necessarily easy to do. But the second thing is that I don't think I am convinced that it would help us treat patients differently. It's like having a full-size spare tire versus a run flat that gets you 50 miles to the nearest gas station. It's good to have, but it's not essential. And so I think we should all make efforts at improving glycemic control in people with type 1 diabetes. And if we are pleasantly surprised, because in some people it's easier than in others, and we can ascribe it to some residual endogenous islet secretion, so be it. But I would stop short of saying that we should be measuring C-peptide in some fashion, because it's going to change how we handle these patients.
Yeah, and I think that it's helpful to tease out the difference here between data that is important and useful to know versus that which is truly actionable. So I think this is would be add to the literature that would get excited about hopeful future therapies that are actually designed towards maintaining any residual beta cell function in folks who have diabetes. And while not directly aimed at that, would suggest that those sort of therapies may be helpful, but whether or not it's actionable for us in our current state with the therapies that we have, and you talked about that earlier in the episode, we may not actually be able to change our behavior just whether we know that information or not. So
Adrian and I agree too often, but I would like to say something that may be controversial. But way back when I had hair and none of it was gray, we were told there's no such thing as brittle diabetes. And I think that what we've learned over the last 30 years from DCCT and subsequent publications such as this is that a little bit of residual beta cell function makes a significant difference in the ease of managing type 1 diabetes. And so studies like this, I think, are important in that regard, in that it's not that people who are tougher to manage, quote unquote, are bad people necessarily or non-adherent people. They simply may have much less residual beta cell function than people who are easier to manage. And I'm sure clinically we have all seen people where you put them on a relatively simple multi-dose regimen and their diabetes is perfectly controlled at every visit. And then there are people who do everything we tell them, go on an insulin pump with a continuous glucose monitor. And whereas their control improves with that technology, it's not as good as the fellow who's doing the relatively simple regimen. My guess is, since we don't do this clinically, that the people who have that relatively easy to control type 1 diabetes probably have more residual beta cell function. And the people who you're lucky to keep in the mid sevens, despite your best efforts in hemoglobin A1C, probably make very little insulin, i.e. C-peptide, at all. So I think conceptually that's important to acknowledge and perhaps even may influence your clinical targets down the road. But I think clinically getting the C-peptide is not very useful except for proving to Medicare that your patient's not making any insulin.
And with that, I would like to thank Steve Whitland and Adrian Vella for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal, as I know that you all did, and hope that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.